You've captured the wild in a way that's enchanted audiences worldwide, but behind every iconic image, there's a human story. What was the single hardest lesson you had to learn to become not just a great wildlife photographer, but a truly successful one?
Gosh, that's a rather general question, actually. What is it that's behind? I mean, we tend to, for me, I focus on projects and particularly books. And in that, you want to have a kind of narrative. It's a journey that every photographer takes. And when I was asked actually by one of your previous people on this, by Steve Bloom, when I first did my first book in 2008, he said, you don't do a finished book, you get separated from it. And I think that when you're really the key for me is storytelling. And that's what gets cited, and the adventures you have and the way you can share that with other people.
Mm. And so many photographers aspire to make a living from photography, but few achieve it at your level. So when you think back, what truly separates the dreamers from maybe the winners or the most successful people in your field?
Gosh, you know, you're equating success with financial reward. And I'd argue that some of the most important photographers probably are not in so much the commercial space or that want to make a difference with photography. They probably have to maybe have jobs to pay the rent, and maybe they spend time going to war zones or they look at issues like climate change. So I think it's quite problematic to kind of equate financial success with effectively, with success as a photographer. I've chosen, like many, to do over the years, do commissions that perhaps were not as focused on what I'm primarily excited about, but maybe allowed me to pursue long-term projects. As you kind of go down, like in life, as you go down a journey, it opens new doors, new possibilities, and maybe there are another opportunities to commoditize. But I think people and myself are perhaps not so driven by economic reward. We just want to be able to continue our work. And so the economics is more so we can perpetuate and keep exploring things we're excited about.
Mm-hmm. And why are you so focused on your books? They're obviously terrific, but what kind of the benefits of that for your work? Why are you drawn to making books and repeating that?
For years, I worked in advertising, design, and that idea of picking up an idea from an agency that you've got to figure out a strategy to solve a problem, as opposed to spending 2 years embedded into an idea, obsessing about it, the excitement of, in a sense, expanding your understanding of a subject, I think gets me much more excited. There is that sense that you're putting something out there that maybe not will be around for a while. And in fact, you kind of once it's put out, it's there. So there's an urgency, there's a sense of you've got to get it right because you can't pull it back. With advertising, it might be that you have a happy client. It doesn't necessarily mean, as you may be aware, that work that pays a lot doesn't equate necessarily to interesting photography. And also there's a point where it might end up in an annual, but whoever goes to annuals anyway. So I think the excitement of a book is that it formulates it starts you on a journey, and I suppose of discovery and the excitement to want to share some of the ideas you trip over on that journey.
Mm. And kind of what is your process of creating the books and figuring out where to put certain images in terms of the order? What goes through your mind when you're trying that process and creating that?
Gosh, I mean, firstly, the process of a book is today, certainly with the demise of books, the kind of books I do are called trade books. They're books that are not just self-published, or I have a few thousand with Gosh Books or Mini Hox and Mini Press, whatever it happens to be. Mine are translated in multiple languages. Those kind of books are harder and harder to put out there, in the sense that the market has diminished. Your generation are not reading books to the same extent as ours. And I wonder what that means. There are some, I think it was Albert Watson, who I believe you've interviewed, said to me years ago, you know, most of these books are catalogs for artists' exhibitions. they're not really books in the sense that they're put together to be an experience. And I think Albert and myself and Steve Bloom and others you've had on the program, all very, you know, we like to create an experience.
Mm. And how do you, this might be a bit too kind of generic, but how do you create that process? How do you separate your, you and Albert's and Steve's books from kind of the less engaging ones? What are some design features you can use, or text you can use in order? Like, how do you make sure your books have the highest engagement and impact and story?
I mean, we're all vastly different in our approach. I mean, Steve Bloom obviously does animals. I think you just want to get something that's engaging, exciting, relevant, and that you structure. I mean, there isn't, I mean, I work with the, obviously, the pace and the pagination. So you turn pages. You don't necessarily go front to back. It might be to front sometimes. So you've got to think how one image works with the other. But also today, the way we use copy or in a book, the way the willingness for people to engage and read text, I think there's less patience. So you, in a way, have to hook people earlier. But when we're designing a book, we're trying to excite people, confuse them, find them again. I can't make comparisons to other people's practices of how they do books. They're in wholly different spheres to myself. But all I'm trying to do is say, at the moment, I'm doing a book on cats. So I can only relate it back to myself. Now, cats are quite a sentimental subject matter. There is quite a long history show cats, or they may be whatever, but there's not a lot of research or science, or not illustrated books, that is. So I make the distinction rather than a book on behavioral cats or something. That's a few images. My images I'd like to achieve compelling images and a critical base where we've actually explored what do certain things mean, and that I would hope that my readers come to my projects, they go away and say, I didn't know that, say, catnip was actually, the reason they go mental over catnip is because actually it reduces it's an insect repellent, so. And then that explains the evolutionary reason. And I want to, in a sense, uncover lots of those stories. So I'm a natural history photographer, but my main interest is that it's driven by the story and the image combined. I mean, the text and the image is very important.
Mm. And speaking of books and how my generation's reading levels have gone down, it's been the lowest since 1990. Do you think there's still a place in photography for, do you think it's still worth it for photographers to create books, even though these reading levels are going down? Is there still going to be a market for it in the future, do you think?
Well, I go back to what Albert Watson was saying, that they end up in catalogs, really, if they're loved. There's still a sort of way of showcasing a photographer's work. But I think that the kind of books that I do that go out to in hundreds of thousands of copies around the world and translated into multiple languages, I don't know where that future is. The publishers I have were expressing how the bookshops were closing down, how the amount of titles being put out there fewer and fewer. And for me to invest, which I've invested quite a lot of time and resources, and I'm talking about over, I think about 140,000 on cats and direct costs. That's not paying myself anything or running a studio. And to do that with that commitment, to go where I needed to get the subject, I'm unlikely to see it back through books, but possibly through other avenues. It could be a documentary, it could be prints. It's hard to tell. But my point is, it's not a revenue in that sense, but it is a way of immersing yourself in something, having an understanding of something in some detail, and from that, other possibilities arise.
Yeah. And your books have been amazing, the ones on dogs. And now, like you said, you've released one on cats. When people open your new book, what reaction or change do you hope they experience when, after going through your book and looking at these fantastic images of cats, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think you're, it sounds like your emphasis is very much on the visual side. What, as I said before, I would hope that actually you find out how extraordinary cats are, how they are the ultimate predators, how they have anatomically, sociologically, the process of domestication, how that was different to dogs, our relationship, even down to questions around cuteness. For example, I actually had an MRI scan of my brain. Now you might wonder, why would I put an MRI scan of my brain in my book? And one of the areas that's quite important, and I'm going to jump forward and then go back to that, is when Tim Berners-Lee was asked by journalists, having invented the web, what surprised him about some of the unusual usages of the web. And he just said kittens. Now, kittens are the second most frequent reason someone goes online. Now, going back to my brain again. So I scanned my brain. Now, the reason for that was I wanted to show how the research on cuteness and how that relates to how we observe infant faces, babies, puppies, kittens. And they stimulate an area around the front here. It's the frontal cortex here. And this part is where empathy is. But adult ones happen somewhere around the side here. And uniquely adult, but the infants only stimulate the front. And they do that faster than 200 milliseconds. Now, for those who know something about how fast we have conscious thought, let's say that it's not 300, it's about a fifth of a second happens, you actually have conscious thought and understand. So you're forming emotions, but you have conscious thought when you look at kittens. And that would explain why bypass, it's like a neurohighway. And so I think this is fascinating. So I was very lucky that a professor, a very eminent professor at Oxford University, came in to write the section on cuteness. And we worked together on that to deliver science into a book on cats. Now, that's not what you think. Or, for example, I have a clay litter tray in a cat book. Now, in my horse book, I had horse shit on this occasion, I've got a litter tray. So the question is, why a litter tray? Well, we're talking about the clay litter revolution, which was to change the breeding of cats, catch them in the home, whereas before they just mated whatever they found outside. Presumably cats, but whatever cat came in the region. So the point was to disrupt the flow by having a cat litter in the picture that then begs the question, what's that about? Just as why has he got a brain in there? And well, how does that relate? So that disruption is quite important. Sometimes you need ambiguity. That is that you need a kind of multiple layers and you need to create a kind of confusion where you have to almost go through a disambiguation, that is unthreading the meaning to then be rewarded by going, that's what's going on here. That's what this crazy guy's doing. This is creating an experience. So one of the philosophers that's very influential in media studies was Walter Benjamin. Now, he described the arts as the organization of experiences. Now, I often think of that his thought on that, because it begs the question, in what context, in what form, and how do you think what you put out will be experienced in the boots of someone else? What empathetic process does it involve to bridge something, to create experience in someone else's bony vault and the wetware that sits in it?
Sounds absolutely fascinating. And speaking of the kind of how dogs and cats have evolved separately in domestication or been naturally selected differently, how could you go into a bit more detail about the differentiation from, I assume dogs were used for hunting and protection, but why did we domesticate cats? What was the use of their domestication?
Dogs, some would argue that dogs, the domestication of the dog, because keep in mind that it was the wolf that they came from. So there's been a long process to get and considerable morphological diversity from, for example, the Great Dane to the poodle to the Chihuahua. You have all sorts of shapes, usually determined by their function and their jobs. Some would even argue that for Homo sapiens to get a bigger brain and get more protein, a collaboration with the dog worked well because they helped us alert us to trouble, and they were good in pushing animals into our area to then in the hunt. So that goes back a long, long way. Now, cats is a very much more recent. I mean, the question is, did cats same kind of approach us, or did we think that's convenient? So what we describe as from hunter-gatherer in bands of people, we weren't collecting food. We were not farmers. It wasn't really until they describe as civilization, where we went from hunter-gatherer to farmer. And in the Fertile Crescent in sort of Mesopotamia, Egypt, that area, where first when farming was established, as a consequence of that, you stockpile grain, for example, that brings vermin, and then you have another problem. And cats obviously thought, well, look here, I've got fat grain-fed rats and mice to eat here. This could be a really good opportunity. So it's very hard to know if we encouraged them or we discovered that actually they're good companionship. But really, it started they're being graves where they buried cats with people that go back as far as 7,000 years. But the most evidence really from Egypt, where we can see the paintings and the tomb paintings, and we can see them as part of the hunt and in the form of Raj, which is the sun god, which is a complex god. He's good and bad and whatever. And another one called Basset, which was a goddess. So they went from they kind of became deities because they were seen for the importance of controlling vermin. Some would argue a ferret does a better job than a cat. And there may be truth, but maybe the ferret is not as good companionship as a cat. Doesn't purr, at least. I don't know. I mean, whatever it is. But in answer to your question, the journey started really about 4,000, 3,500 years ago. For the most part, the cat's job didn't really change. It was for mousing, really. It was vermin control. And it wasn't really really wasn't until the latter 19th century that people started having cats more inside. And really the breeds have increased considerably since the 1960s, going back to clay litter. From the period the clay litter came in to sort of adopted by a lot of people as a way of having cats in the home. We're really speaking of the 60s to around the 50s, 60s. Since that time, the registered breeds have gone from 6 to about 48 breeds. It has jumped hundreds of percent, not in the case of dogs. So cats, for the most part, have been left to be their natural form. They were actually the progenitor, or the cat that was the main genetic origin of all domestic cats, we can now establish was a northern African wildcat. But when a cat spends a lot of time in Siberia, somewhere cold, they get a long coat over hundreds of years. And so we have big, heavy mancoons that in Nordic kind of environments, northern forest cat and the Siberian are big, heavy cats with a lot of coat.
Hmm. And what was maybe the most memorable or difficult or hardest shoot that you had to do for this feline project was, where did you have to go to get all these rare exotic species
that I had to do?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the exciting parts of being a photographer, is you can orchestrate your own adventures. That is, you don't quite know what's going to happen. Well, there've been quite a lot of different ones. We've got certain cats, which are so extraordinary. Some that have we have one we call Zaro. He's called Zoo, actually. He has a mask over his eyes. And he was in Borneo, so that was a fair way to go. And then we have another cat that looks a bit like a football, a kawaii kind of fluff ball. And he was in Japan. So we've had to sort of go to some of these really unusual cats. There are some that are so surprising they are literally half one color and half another. It's like a line drawn down the middle, like photoshopped. Because of that, we had to go down another route, which was to effectively document us working on these projects, because the cats are surprising in themselves. And as we enter an era of Gen AI, much of this will come into question, whether they were ever there. You know, the past, it might have been, how do you keep the cat still on set? Now it's, how do you prove it was ever there in the first place? We're moving through a very, you know, these are paradigm shifts as the visual lexicon, that's an oxymoron, but is changing, and it's changing remarkably fast.
Speaking of Gen AI, how do you ensure that your images are proven to not be generated by AI? And what are some of the challenges that photographers must overcome probably in the next few decades with Gen AI? How do you adapt to this paradigm shift?
Hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you, or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, adapt. I think we will have to adapt. The genie, as they say, won't go back in the bottle. But you can ask more questions of Gen AI than the genie. I think it was only three, wasn't it? Three wishes. But you go on prompting for as long as you like with Gen AI. How do you future-proof? And I can reflect back to what we've done. We've got these cute QR codes in the form of cats. That gives us the footage that does give you some evidence that they existed. We have cats that are literally, they're called chimera and some mosaicing, where you're almost the genetics of two cats in one, to give evidence of that. So I think photographers are going to progressively have to be very careful when they craft something through Photoshop, that it doesn't just look like it's kind of generative AI, that the evidence, the way it goes back into what we deem to be reality, and the way that is then changed or polluted or contaminated by the inability to distinguish whether something existed or didn't exist. What I'm saying is Gen AI has thrown up and will only get better. And it is in embryonic stages at the moment. And so what I probably say is, how do you future-proof? Well, I think you've got to be interested in the world you're in. You've got to see how you yourself are reading different images differently. I was looking at a colleague's photograph that he'd done 10 years ago, thinking it doesn't look real. I knew it was real because he wouldn't have done the Gen AI wasn't there. But the point is that it was a studio shot where he'd really crafted the hat and all the bits around him. And you just looked at it and didn't connect to it the same way that I would have done looking at the same picture, because it's now polluted by the proximity or the feeling the picture has to something that's written in 15 seconds by a prompt. And I think that this is interesting, because I can see it myself without, in a sense, someone your age looking at it, shaped much more by these shifts are for you very much as you know them.
So are you saying it's changed the way you see certain images?
It is change, and it'd be naive to think we're not changing. In fact, it's hard to do that.
Can we talk more about preparation? Because you've clearly read so much, obviously, about cats and the evolution of them, and you've had to go to Borneo to photograph these incredible pets and specimens. How do you research and plan ahead for a shoot, and what's involved that most people don't see? And how important is research for you in your practice?
Well, I mean, obviously research is a very broad term. If you were in academia, you'd be talking about, you know, expanding the human knowledge, wouldn't you? Research sounds like just doing your homework and figuring out and understanding the concept. There's multiple questions there. There's a side that to understand the meaning of a picture and how it resonates is to understand its need to understand the cultural context. if you're working with an animal, you have to have, you could almost say empathy. You have to be able to imagine what the animal's sensing. Is it stressed by the situation? Is it comforted by having its owner there? Or it is a wild animal, an environment where it's not too scary and different. So research, obviously it's a term, we often say that, but I think that there's a difference between bringing sort of current research papers, literally, and we've been doing that on this book. We've been working with Jonathan Losos, an evolutionary biologist, and Morten Kreidelbach, who is a neuroscientist based at Oxford, in collaboration with this book. But we have gone through the papers and the journals to actually understand current thought around a number of aspects of feline. Feline being the name of my cat.
So you're researching and, well, not research, you're looking at new scientific papers about cats before you go out into the field.
For example, we phoned up Dan O'Neill, who's a professor at the Royal Veterinary College, and he's the world leading in ethics. He talks about brachycephalic breeds with flat faces to look more cute and how that affects the health and how, you know, we should be looking for health over looks, the breeding for health over looks. So we will I will phone up someone and just say, please advise. I mean, we asked ChatGPT, who are the world's two leading cat eye experts? And it threw up two names, and we got the email in the feed, and we emailed them back some questions and got a response the same day. So it's possible to use any tool to get there. But obviously, I think orthodox would say, well, we research. They do, but it depends what you mean by research. Does it mean predicting better what's going to happen on the day? Or does it actually involve exploring further in depth the meaning and, I suppose, the history and the research around something?
Mm. And how do you find the subjects? Are you scrolling on like cat Instagram or Facebook, or how are you finding the owners and like contacting them? For example, the cat with two different colors on its face. Like, how did you find these fascinating subjects?
Well, I think it reminds me, I was asked this by someone a few weeks back, you know, what would you advise a person to do if they're starting a journey as a photographer? And I'd probably say, be curious and stay curious. But now I think be brave and reach out is probably what I'd say. In the post-pandemic era, I think it's progressively more scary for young people to reach out. And I was amazed how we would just phone people up around the world, and they pretty much said, yes, let's come to us and we'll do that, or I'll come back and advise you. So collaboration is so important. For any of you young photographers out there, I'm afraid you only get braver if you take on the scary and talk to people, meet people, and you'll be amazed what doors open for you.
Mm, definitely. Very, very good advice. And have you been doing that approach since you've begun your journey? Have you always been that brave?
I'm brave is separate to have I actually reached out. Yes, I've reached and I got braver because I'm still survived and still here.
Yeah.
I started with horses and then I went to dogs. Then I went to I've been through, this is my sixth main body of work done over several years. And we calculated, but we probably reached out to 100 people for this book project. We didn't just go to a cat cafe and shoot 20 cats. We chose the cat. We chose when in the year for a long coat cat, it was going to have the best coat, when it was going to be in the best condition, the age, the so many factors. And for that, absolutely, we rely on everyone. I rely on April behind me as the partner in doing this. On the amazing wranglers we have, handling the wild animals or weather or advising us, and the show cats and the expertise. I think that's half the fun of it. The adventure, which is how you started this conversation earlier, is where you don't know the outcome of where you're going to go. And in aesthetics, interesting, there's a parallel. For us evolutionarily to adapt, we need to maintain continual new pathways in our neural networks. They call it plasticity. And so in aesthetics, there's this idea of disambiguation, where you're thrown into something that you, in some ways, you can't even discern, but it's the act of discerning it which makes you feel most alive. And the act of being most alive is in that moment when you're disambiguation. The prediction is important because we couldn't put one foot in front of the other. We'd fall over. So we need habits. We need prediction. Predictable things. But we also need to find that space which draws us out and pushes us down another avenue. Maybe a new skill set, maybe new people, and a new experience.
Mm. So is it kind of embracing the uncertainty and then putting in the work to reduce the uncertainty once you're actually there with the subject and shooting it? Because you don't want it to go wrong on the shoot.
Well, I think uncertainty is part of life anyway. It's just which uncertainty you want and which adventure. You want it to be a bigger adventure, then you probably have to take the initiative. If you want to be obsessed about a hole in your carpet at home, then you can do that. But I think the problems don't go away.
Mm, yes, very true. And you mentioned this is your sixth kind of major project. How do you maintain both quality and motivation in your work over decades? Because I'm sure a lot of people struggle with inconsistency.
Well, I think there's obviously several aspects to that. One is you've been there and survived. I've produced a book. I kind of know the process and I've got skill sets that help me, you know, do the bleeds and preparing the files. I do my own Photoshop work. So most photographers who have got a profile tend to give a lot of their retouching away. I actually have always chosen to do it personally. So those skill sets keep growing. Can you repeat that question? Because I'm not actually answering.
No worries. How do you maintain both quality and motivation in your work over the decades? And how do you maintain that consistency?
So obviously, quality is as Ernst Gombrich once said, in the eye of the beholder, whatever you think quality is. The interesting thing is that the technology gets better and better and better. And we now use eye tracking, which has meant that we barely have to worry about locking that point on the eye of the animal. So it changes the methodology. It's getting easier and easier. So there's a degree of quality increase. It's got nothing to do with me. It's got to do with the fact that actually those things have been better and better dealt with by the emerging the technologies. In terms of quality, if I don't deliver a book to my publisher that kind of is in keeping with the development of technique, it's kind of moving things along, then they simply won't publish it. And that's it. So you always have the uncertainty, even when you're at my stage in my career, that you've got to deliver. But I don't mind that because that's what drives me to think, shit, I better get this right. I better make the extra effort. I must change my schedule and just get it done. You also need to get a good instinct for what's going to be important. What is this that really could, how can I say, be, you've got to have an instinct for what really works. And also be a self-critic as well. I also, my friends come in here. I'm going to swing this so you can see. There's a sort of board of prints here. Whoops, let me try and get this angle. It's very difficult with these cameras because they're the wrong way around. But anyway, a board of images there. And those images are printed versions. And we also have InDesign. My friends come in and I ask them, tell me which one, what annoys you. And they're usually fairly frank. And you've got to be clear about able to step back, forget something, know it very well, step back, hear how other people are experiencing it. It isn't about just saying, they see that, so I'm going to change everything. It's about understanding how your work is viewed in somebody else's shoes. The ability to be a communicator is slightly different from self-therapy or existentialism. In this case, insight into inner psychology. Not saying it's a bad thing, but ultimately, if you really want to create experiences for other people, you've got to be able to imagine and manifest what would that be to someone else. And that is where you become a communicator, a bit visual in my case, rather than just simply self-therapy. Now, it's slightly different to the commercial side because you started this conversation. How do you become a successful photographer? How do you make money? Well, That's just an outcome. It's not whether you create great pictures. And unfortunately, the history of photography has many incredible contributors to the medium, and some of them never made a penny. As you know, Van Gogh only sold 2 paintings in his life. You know, it does not equate to whether it's good or bad. In fact, some of the biggest crap is done by very successful commercial photographers. And great pictures are done by commercial photographers. It doesn't correlate.
Yeah. And just going back to fear as a motivator, have you read about the study with the rat and the cheese before?
I think you're alluding to a paper which I can't quote, if that's what you're asking me.
No. I'm talking about there was a study where they had a rat in a tube and they attached its tail to a coil to measure how much it would be pulling towards something. And they wafted the smell of cheese in the front and then measured it, and it pulled relatively high. But then they wafted the smell of a cat from behind and it pulled way harder. And the conclusion of that is fear is a very strong motivator.
I don't know that one, but it kind of doesn't surprise me. I mean, what you're really talking about is survival. Success is the priority. The reason that, if we go back to my earlier discussion about cuteness, the reason that cuteness is important and it's given a priority in terms of neuro highway, i.e. you get fast, is because it's important for our evolution success. And survival success is ultimately the driver. And I would argue that the arts work with perceptual mechanisms that are part of the way we construct our reality. And the reality is only there for our survival success. There is no reality. It's just what we need to survive.
100%. We've only got a few more minutes. So for a few ending questions, looking ahead, are you optimistic or concerned about the state of biodiversity and conservation worldwide, in your opinion?
Well, it'd be very odd if I said I wasn't. I think the more useful question might be is what can we do about it, I suppose. And as our population is now in 8 billion, isn't it? And we are definitely in what is described as the age of the Anthropocene, one shaped by us. We have evidence of things happening that usually happen when the whole planet goes through a mass extinction. And they're usually marked by gaps in the coral reefs because the carbon levels. So yes, we do need to somehow make people care. The projects I work on with social scientists, I'm working on big research projects in America with 70,000 participants funded by the National Science Foundation. And one of the things that we're looking at is how to create empathy. Because if people can place themselves in the boots of other, in case animals or others, they're more likely to act and do what we call create pro-environmental outcomes. What we desperately need to do is to connect people to nature. Our future depends on it. There's no getting away from that. And so many of us as photographers, and there are progressively quite a few photographers now out there who are coming together to explore exactly that question. How do we tell the stories in a powerful way that make us truly care? If we don't examine how we communicate partly to create social change, we're heading in a very difficult direction. And as we are now seeing, you know, obviously the climate change and extreme weather conditions, they called it, there is a phrase, I've lost it now. It's a way in which we see distortion of conditions where some places get wetter, some get colder, some get warmer. So the answer is that I am concerned that as we enter an era that's already started to meant face-to-face times we're having here is being reduced. The way that our realities are constructed is based more on virtual than actual. It's progressively moving in that direction. I think you have to have a world that is very actual and virtual. We need to encourage people to spend time in the forest to, you know, reduce attention deficit problems. This goes back to the biophilia hypothesis of E.O. Wilson. There's lots and lots of evidence. I would encourage people to go out and spend time. But I really think we need to care and be perceptive of the actual world out there And the more we immerse ourselves in a virtual, the more we're in danger of detaching ourselves to such an extent that we're not going to be in a position to respond in a way that can create the change we need. So that's not really, it's a really difficult, it's a huge question. The answer is, of course I am, but I would like to think that the museum shows I do around the world with the storytelling about the animals and the hundreds, well, the millions of people who've seen my shows in, say, China and other places around the world will be introduced to ideas and hopefully to those characters and personalities of my animals and consider their stories and be empathetic to that. I believe being empathetic is one of the key elements to us making and bridging that sense of otherness to sameness, bridging it from the other to into our world.
And that's exactly what I, from my perspective, think your images are so successful at doing. Like you said about the areas of your brain that trigger empathy, your images 100% for me do that, including, for example, the fruit bat picture in one of your books. That a lot of people may find fruit bats ugly, but you've been able to trigger the empathy in my brain. So hopefully that will be the same for many people.
The image where I turned the bat upside down, was it?
Yeah.
Yes. And I
I'm probably a bias though, because I have had fruit bat pictures on my wall for about 10 years. So maybe it's a bias, yeah.
So you feel a more empathy for the bats. They're extraordinary. They say a lot about us. They create, they do what we now understand is they project through ultrasound. They project sound from inside out, creating a map of the world. And now we believe that we do that to some degree as humans. We create a gendered map of the world and update our data to see that the inferences are correct and that best guess is more accurate.
Wow. I'd love to have a whole separate conversation on that, but we'll cut it there. Tim Flack, ladies and gentlemen. Tim, like I said, really appreciate your time and your work. And where can people go if they want to find your new book?
Well, my new book comes out on the 7th of October. I think it's already on Amazon. So I think it's in this day and age when you can find pretty much things pretty easy, can't you? So I think, but it will be out there, and we're just excited in a couple of weeks to see maybe the first advanced copies and hope it's not been messed up and that it's, you know, we're quite OCD here. We get very kind of into the detail.
Of course, I think
as photographers, you should care. That's another thing. So just to recap, I think one should be curious and stay curious. You should care and you should be brave and reach out.
110% agree, Tim. Thank you very much. I'll leave the links to all your work in the show notes and good luck with the project.
Thank you.